Every now and then, around this time of the year, a newspaper gets a retired detective to do a cold case investigation of the resurrection of Jesus. Having to read the Bible, even if it's only the tail end of the Gospels, must be a novel experience for some of these ex-Rozzers who probably haven't been near a church or a sacred text since Sunday school, if that. Still, lack of church culture or any understanding of the Christian faith doesn't stop journalists these days opining authoritatively on church matters. Did you notice the recent TV One report on the burning of Notre Dame Cathedral, in which one reporter told us that the cathedral was a centre of French cultural life and historical association, but failed to mention that it's the mother church of the Archdiocese of Paris and a centre of French Catholic devotion? Another, on that same night, informed us that the crown of thorns stored in the cathedral treasury was thought to have been worn by Christ at his resurrection, which would have been a very helpful identifier in his resurrection appearances, I am sure. Incidentally, although I think sacred relics can be a helpful adjunct of faith, I am highly sceptical of the authenticity of this particular relic. You can just about bet money that these cold case investigations will conclude that the body of Jesus was spirited away from the tomb by either the friends or the foes of Jesus for their own nefarious purposes. If only we had CCTV footage, DNA sampling and high-speed data processing computer programs to assist us, these investigators might think. But all they have to go on are the accounts written by the early Christian community. The underlying sceptical assumptions they bring to these texts and the fact that their employing newspapers wouldn't thank them for an it's all true story generally condition the final outcome of what they will write. Perhaps it would help these latter-day investigators if they understood that the first witnesses of the resurrection were also hard to convince that this is what had happened, despite their having been given inside information on what lay on the other side of tragic death for their inspiring leader. That is certainly the way Luke tells it. Luke lays out the resurrection appearances of Jesus in four scenes: this evening's discovery of the empty tomb, accompanied by an angelic message; the encounter of the incognito Christ to two disciples on the road to Emmaus; then the appearance of Jesus to all the disciples; and finally, his farewell to them at Bethany. In the first two scenes, those who encounter the first evidence for the resurrection either do not understand at first what is happening, or they do not recognize him, or they refuse to believe what they've just heard. What we've just heard is a classic case in point. The women who have arrived to anoint the dead body of Jesus discover to their consternation the empty tomb, together with the probable initial conclusion that body snatchers have been at work. A terrifying encounter follows with two men who glow with heavenly glory, whose words of explanation have an almost accusatory tone to them. "Remember what he said," is the take-home message, and they do remember. Armed with this impressive aid memoir, they are the first to come to Easter faith, and so they return to tell the 11 of their startling news. If they're expecting a warm welcome and a receptive audience, they're in for disappointment. To quote the text, "This story of theirs seemed pure nonsense, and they did not believe them." There is one flicker of positive response. Peter, at least, is prepared to go and see for himself. He picks up on one piece of evidence that the overwhelmed women had missed: the abandoned binding cloths that had wrapped the dead corpse. That at least tells against the grave robber theory. No body snatcher in his right mind would take off the one layer of protective covering that would shield him from contagion from a rapidly decaying cadaver. But that doesn't necessarily prove anything. Peter may be amazed and open to the possibility that something remarkable has happened, but he's yet to come to the full realization and wholehearted faith of the women witnesses. One of the marks of authenticity about the Gospels is that they face head-on some of the difficult and disagreeable and uncomfortable facts about the life, death, and ministry of the one who was at the centre of their story and about those who are his followers. It was acutely embarrassing that Jesus had been betrayed by one of his closest followers. It was an inconvenient truth that, by and large, the Jewish contemporaries of Jesus did not believe him or take his teaching to heart. It was even more uncomfortable to admit that the immediate followers of Jesus had run away and abandoned him at the last. And last but not least, despite the disciples having been told in clear, unmistakable and repeated ways about what would happen on the other side to death of their remarkable leader, they did not get it. The Gospels are also frank about the unusual and in some ways not entirely straightforward nature of the resurrection appearances. They are not about a return to business as usual for a momentarily knocked down Jewish prophet. John Nolland sums up the extraordinary mixture of experiences that constitute meeting the risen Lord when he writes, "Of those associated with the disciples' community, only those associated with the disciple community had the experience. Jesus turns up unexpectedly. His identity was not at once obvious, but could be confidently affirmed by the end. The experience convinced them that Jesus had come through death and moved beyond. It seemed that the resurrection sphere into which he had moved was not such that he could be expected to take up where he'd left off. Rather, Jesus was showing himself to them, and then he would disappear. The encounter transformed them and left them with a powerful sense of commission for a mission task." There is one other thing that's worth noting. These appearances only occurred for a limited time. The resurrection appearances of Jesus do not have a knockdown quality of demonstrable truth about them, but given the initially sceptical response of his immediate followers, they are, in my view, highly probable. The insider group, far from being credulous and highly suggestible, were hard to convince and reluctant to come to the conclusion that Jesus had prepared them for. This is a pointer to the authenticity of what we celebrate tonight. Yet in the end, this is a matter of faith. We believe in this, what has come to be the central truth of the Christian faith, because it has in some way found us in our interior core, not because it's been demonstrated to us in an unmistakable and empirically verifiable way. This is what faith is all about, an act of trust in what are unseen realities. But the church doesn't invite us to leave our brains at the door as we enter St. Peter's to celebrate the resurrection of Christ on this most holy night. There are good grounds for believing what we believe. The gospel accounts carry us a good way along the way before we make the interior decision to stake our lives on the truth of the resurrection of Jesus Christ and its implications for everyone and everything around us. Intelligent people who are prepared to admit that there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in the philosophies of our age have every reason to rejoice in what we've just heard this evening. Spoken in the name of God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.